from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Up next in this morning's forum program, before Borat and The Daily Show, there was Coyle and Sharp.
This is Mal Sharp with another in the series, Job Opportunities. Every day I bring an employer out onto the street and have him offer a San Franciscan an interesting and novel job.
The 1960s San Francisco radio comedy team of Mal Sharp and Jim Coyle helped pave the way for today's prankster comedians with their absurdist man-on-the-street interviews. We'll talk with Mal Sharp about the art of the put-on, his long career in Bay Area broadcasting, and his Dixieland band, Big Money in Jazz. He'll join us as part of our first-person series on the leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area unique after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. In the early 60s, Mel Sharp and his partner Jim Coyle made names for themselves by doing man-on-the-street interviews for KGO Radio, and they became well-known for their put-on, prankster, often surreal humor. Mel Sharp worked as well for Camel Radio and in television and in the commercial world, as well as playing jazz trombone at places like Enrico's and Savoy Tivoli, with a group called Big Money in Jazz. As part of our ongoing first-person series focusing on those who make the Bay Area unique, we want to welcome the legendary, I use that word advisedly, Mal Sharp, to this.
Who advised you there?
You and Lillian Hellman with her Black M and Mink. Actually, talking about the genesis of The Man on the Street, which many people remember with long memories. You know, we were talking about, before we went on the air, about Steve Allen, and he was an antecedent to you, but you guys really did it in a different way. You did it in your own way.
Well, there was Candy Cameron, and Steve Allen would go out, like in front of the Ranch Market in Hollywood, and interview people. We were much more surrealistic. We were much more interested in painting these scenes of bizarre terror and challenges to people on the streets of San Francisco. We walked around with a hidden tape recorder for 2 years before anybody hired us in and out of mortuaries and paint stores and whatever. So it was a much more kind of heady thing, I like to think.
And not necessarily political, although you used to use the word terror, terrorizations of people. It was, in fact, described as anarchic and all that, but
yeah.
It didn't really have a political necessarily.
No, that word terrorization was my partner, Jim Coyle. He was a great wordster guy. And this is, you know, back in 1961. Terrorization didn't have the same connotation it has today. You know, life has changed. You know, this was just, we're going to go in and...
And people on the street have changed. They're probably, as I think you've pointed out, a bit more paranoid, maybe more narcissistic about wanting to be on camera, on microphone. And
you've
all
noticed
that.
Yeah.
This was an early time when, in fact, let's just hear a clip from this early time. This is... Mel Sharp and his partner approaching a man in downtown San Francisco with what we could characterize as an unusual proposition.
We've just stopped a gentleman, a young man who's in the Navy. Could we have your name, please?
Lewis.
Lewis, I'd like you to meet James P. Coyle.
Glad to meet you.
Glad to meet you.
Now, Lewis, Mr. Coyle is going to tell you very briefly about a film he's working on here in the city, and after he finishes, if you want to discuss any aspect of it,
I'd like feel free. I really would.
Fine. Mr. Coyle, would you tell Lewis about the film?
Very good. The name of the film is Daring But Dead. The idea is very simply... it centers around a bank robbery, which takes place in a city. We hope to approach it in a unique way, and we're actually going to film it in a bank. Do you understand the nature of it?
Yeah, I mean, I come from Philadelphia. I'd like to know it. I really would.
Right. Everybody in the bank will be actors, but we're going to try and get the main role, in other words, the protagonist of this film. We're going to use a person without dramatic background. Would you yourself be interested in... giving a crack at that role? There's no money involved, but there's a possibility for fame.
Yes, I really would. I mean, I think it'd be a good film. I really do. I honestly do.
The idea is you are to go in the bank, ask for $11,000. You can use some type of a weapon or not. And we are actually, I've chosen Mr. Sharp from the radio station, and myself are playing two of the other roles in the film. We'll be sitting out in a car outside the bank. Would you be willing to give it a try?
I would be, because I'm a gunner's mate in the Navy, and I know I could do it. I mean, I just walk in, I'd hold it up.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the man that's never committed a crime before is the one that can do it.
Right,
that's
exactly
true. I could do it. I mean, I can get hold of a machine gun. I can get hold of any kind of weapon you want.
Would you be willing? We're doing some filming this afternoon. Would you be willing to try it?
Yes, I would.
Fine, we'll go up to a bank here. Would you be able to get a hold of a weapon this afternoon?
Yeah, I would.
So eager to be enlisted, yeah. This guy from Philadelphia. What that had to do with anything?
Yeah, right. I'm in Philadelphia. I could do it, you know.
What happened with him, by the way?
What do you mean, what happened to him? That's a good question,
Michael. He didn't rob the bank, I take it.
Well, the idea was he was going to go in and rob the bank. You know, we were going to film this, and he'd come out to the car with the money, and we'd ride off. And then we told him that it wasn't really a movie, that he'd actually be robbing the bank. And he said, you two guys can pull this off. He had faith in us. He says, you two guys with that line of life, he says, you can pull it off. I'll get a gun. You know, I'm a gunner's mate in the Navy. We told him it was a joke. And he said, you guys have a lot of guts with a cop standing right there. It was down on Powell on Market Street, you know.
Actually, I think with all the bits you did, there was just something called the cops once on you?
Yeah, we were out at a Chevrolet dealer out in the avenues, and we were in the showroom, we wanted them to bring, when they went out on a test drive, bring people up to our mansion up on the hill and bring them inside, and we would give these people an injection, and then we would give the salesman from the car dealership $50 for bringing the person up there, because it was an experiment we were working on, and we needed people to inject, and this crowd formed around us at Holiday Chevrolet out there, all the other salesmen. And we could hear the siren in the background coming down whatever that street is. And Coyle and I kind of said goodbye rapidly and jumped on the J car or something and left before the cop got there. So,
well, there are some things that you were proposing that I suppose could have brought officers of the law. I mean,
that's right.
One of them that comes swiftly to my mind was when you came up with this idea. Let me just set this up a little bit. Went into a pharmacy and asked the pharmacist if you could have sterilized equipment because you wanted to do heart surgery in the car. Yeah.
No, we had a van around the corner.
And the van,
we always had a van around the corner where we would perform these operations. Yeah.
So these ideas came from where? Just
ether? The ether. We would get up in the morning. I lived up on Telegraph Hill. Jim lived over in the Pacific Heights. We'd meet in some coffee shop, and we'd premisize. We would try and come up with concepts. You know, you'd look around the room, you know, like, you know, I look at this clock over here in your studio, and we would write down on a piece of paper, be a human clock, you know, and we would tell some guy in the street later in the day, we can put the workings of a new, you know, electronic clock the Japanese have devised so your face could become the face of a clock. I don't know. But we would write all these premises down on a sheet of paper and then go out. Sometimes they would work. Sometimes they wouldn't work for months. Sometimes we'd think of something else when we encountered people in the streets.
Sometimes they were just so silly. You know, like, remember one about crossing a zebra and an eel?
The Zebiel.
Zebiel, yeah.
Zebiel has lived. Recently, some scientist sent me a jar. It was a combination of a zebra and an eel, and it was going to be a watch animal for this paint store out on Gary Street. You put it on the window, and if somebody comes in that's threatening them, the zebra and the eel expand to like 6 feet and attack them. And, you know, the guy was rather put off by it.
Talking to Mal Sharpe, who's here with us in the studio, part of our first-person series, and a man inspired maybe, as he said, by Alan Fund and Canon Camera, but who certainly inspired people like Ali G and Howard Stern and, for that matter, Leno and Letterman and so many of these, I think even the Merry Pranksters, so many of these almost institutions that we take for granted. Let's hear another bit from Coyle and Sharpe. This is again, from that era of the 60s.
This is Mal Sharpe with another in the series Job Opportunities. Every day I bring an employer out onto the street and have him offer a San Franciscan an interesting and novel job. Now, I have James P. Coyle with me, our employer of the day, and I've just stopped a young man who we're going to offer a job to.
I am James P. Coyle, and I'm very glad to meet you.
Same here.
The nature of the job is it's a little unusual. Just like anything else, there are certain risks entailed in it. You would be working down in a pit in which I have created, through scientific endeavor, I have created intense flame. People throw objects in the flaming pit. You go through. You pick them up. They name the object. You pick them up, and I charge them admission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'd be interested. It's something new and exciting, you know, and black excitement.
The reason I ask, I had an employee before, and I will tell you this directly and honestly. And he was a little careless and incautious. I gave him specific instructions, and he perished. Now, I want you to understand this before we get any further. He did perish.
I understand. Well, mistakes can happen sometimes.
What we're trying to do, really, is to create a living hell. Have people pay admission. They look down in the pit. They see you down there. The flames are all around you. There will be four maniacs with you, and you've got to control them.
No, wait a minute. I understand that you said four maniacs?
Yes.
Yeah. It sounds very interesting.
Have you worked with maniacs before?
No, never.
Those just never age, do they?
You know, I can see these things so vividly. You know, once again, that was down on Powell Street. And, you know, he was really a nice guy. He sounded like a nice guy, yeah. We never wanted to promise people money or anything like that. We were very careful about that. But we would pose these questions. And he was an eager guy. And we would just keep making it worse and worse. Not only were there maniacs down there, but I don't know. I think he finally, when we told him he'd have to cook a bat, that was where he drew the line. You know, he wasn't going to, you know, if he wanted lunch, he had to cook a bat or something. He's like, no, I'm not going to do this, you know. But it took a long while to get him to.
But the desire to please you guys and the naivete and the cooperativeness and everything, that's really what's striking in these first two that we've heard.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of archaeology to me when I listen to these people's voices, you know, back then in the early 60s. They're kind of naive. They haven't been brainwashed by the media. They're not. You know, the microphone still gets them nervous a little bit. They're a little kowtowed. We would wear suits and ties, so we look like respectable guys, you know, but then we'd be backing them up against the wall a few minutes later, you know.
This stuff never ended. Even when Coyle died, you were making up stories about how he died, you know, parachuting and underneath the streets of Barcelona and all that.
Yeah. I mean, I could never, Jim would never like me to say that, you know, how he really died. I mean, he passed away from diabetes or something like that. So I always, I had him, and he was a monk in Tibet, you know, and had taken a vow of silence, which people couldn't believe that Coyle stopped talking, you know, but that he had taken a vow of silence for the last 20 years or something. But it was always good to see it in print. Even the Chronicle printed something I said about, yeah, how he died. And was it tunneling under Barcelona? He was in some cave-in. He was in the tunneling.
What brought you to San Francisco?
You know, it was just a whim. I went to graduate school at Michigan State University.
In broadcasting?
Yeah, radio and TV. Yeah. Big, heavy-duty major, Michael. Don't look down on me for that.
No, wouldn't do that, no. You're taller than I am.
You know, and I was, I finished the year. I had a few months before I went in the Army. Everybody had to go in the Army then. It was right after Korea. And I think I saw an album cover of a Turk Murphy record, and they were these real exotic people on the cover with Turk Murphy. Bohemians, I guess. And I just said, I don't know, I think I'll go out to San Francisco. And I just flew out here. I didn't know what the city was like. I had no, you know.
Were you a jazz trombonist then?
I had a trombone with me. I wasn't, you know, I don't even consider that I've become a trombonist, Michael. I play at it, you know what I mean? But I had a trombone.
You're being modest. I've heard you, and maybe we'll hear a little bit of the.
Okay. But, you know, I just came out here. I got a job at Macy's after I was here a day or so. And after I was here 2 weeks, this girl that worked at Macy's said, I have an area, a place I live. I think you'd find it interesting. And I got on the cable car with her, and I went up on Powell Street. We got to the top of Knob Hill, and I looked over, and I said, what's all that water down there? I've been in San Francisco 2 weeks. She said, well, that's the bay. What's that? She said, that's the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, that's how naive. You know, people weren't as hip to media then. And, you know, everyone's seen the Golden Gate Bridge now, you know, and the Bay, you know, on TV and stuff. But I'd never seen it. So she took me down to her pad in North Beach, where she had a mattress on the floor and an orange crate. And she lived with a guy who she wasn't having sex with. You know, he just slept in the other room. And I thought, this is so cool, you know. This is so cool, you know.
This is for me.
This is
a mattress on the floor and inviting me to her pad.
Yeah, with an orange crate. You know, what more?
Well, maybe can we hear a little bit of Beale Street Blues? This is Big Money in Jazz, an obviously ironic title for Mel Sharpe's group. Here they are.
How you guys doing today? Hey. Everybody happy? I want to welcome you to the Savoy Tivoli with the Big Money Jazz Band. It's
December. Things are getting chilly here on Grand Avenue. So we're going to heat things up with W.C. Handy's Beale Street Blues.
From the band's live album, which was recorded at the Savoy Tivoli, Mel Sharp playing Beale Street Blues with the Big Money in Jazz band. It's a good sound. It's a really good sound and a popular one.
Oh, we have a great time. You know, North Beach has just been a fount of inspiration for me my whole life. You know, I met my wife, Sandra. She lived in the corner of Grant and Union with her mother way back in the early 60s, looking over her apartment, looked over Iacopi's butcher shop. I don't know if you remember Iacopi's.
She invited you to her pad with her mother?
Oh, yeah. Well, her mother was a bohemian, too, you know, had come out from New York. And so I've just been kind of playing around the neighborhood. We played Enrico's for 10 years, but the Savoy Tivoli is really special because...
Still playing there on Saturdays, aren't you?
We are at the Savoy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's right on the street on Grand Avenue. I'm sort of sitting. There's a little wall between me and the sidewalk. We can talk to all the people that stop out there, so I can still put people
still
on.
Still talking to people.
Well, it really works, you know, because all
with
these
handcuffs
tourists...
or without? Some of your bits, I should just say for listeners, I don't want to get too inside here, but we go into, like, for a test drive to an automobile place and have handcuffs on. I'd be talking to a guy, and then suddenly the guy would see the handcuff. I mean, this would always get some response.
Obviously. Yeah, that was a hidden camera thing we did for a TV show where, you go in at first, you don't reveal the handcuffs, you know, that you're in handcuffs and you're asking the guy, you know, if he would take you out on a test ride in the car and drop you off at the Oakland airport, you know, and then he sees the handcuffs for the first time. And I just want to get dropped off at the airport, you know.
I saw your pilot with George Fenneman, graduate of San Francisco State and former Groucho guy many people remember from the old Groucho Marx show. You were going to do a show called The Imposters, you and Coyle.
Yeah. We left. We were working at KGO. We were doing a nightly show. But we got a contract with David Walper down in Los Angeles to do this television pilot. So without telling anybody at KGO, we moved to L.A. And we still were doing our radio show. We'd stand on the Santa Monica Pier and say, it's Coyle and Sharp down on Market Street and with our question of the day. But we did this television pilot for David Walper. He was just getting into this, handheld cameras. He would cover all the political conventions with his crews and stuff. So we did this kind of surrealistic and bizarre, kind of a candid camera.
Talk about your career in television. We've got a TV segment here that I want listeners to hear. You were covering the Geraldine Ferraro speech when she accepted the Democratic vice presidential nomination at the Democratic National Convention, which was here in San Francisco in 1984. And let's hear Mel Sharp at it.
Well, this is a dramatic moment in American history. Geraldine Ferraro has just accepted the vice presidential nomination, the first woman to be nominated for vice president. Is this exciting?
Extremely exciting. Looking forward to an extremely successful
November. Okay. What's your favorite fish?
My favorite fish?
Yeah.
Tuna.
What is it?
Tuna.
Tuna. Okay. How you doing? Are you excited about this?
Very proud to be a woman tonight. It was a marvelous speech.
Okay. We always ask this. What's your favorite fish?
Sea bass.
Sea bass. Mine too.
I'm from Puerto Rico.
What's your favorite fish?
Fish?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
What's your favorite fish? What do you like?
I love codfish.
Codfish. Governor of Arizona, how you doing?
Look, it's a historic moment. It was a terrific speech. She's really the master of her style. It's really upbeat.
Governor of Arizona, what's your favorite fish?
Striped bass.
Striped bass. All right, you heard it from the governor. Thanks a lot.
That's very funny. That was Bruce Babbitt, who was then governor, not even hesitating when you asked about favorite fish. Yeah. Same thing happened, I think, soon after that when you talked to... Who was it?
Alan Cranston.
Senator Cranston. Yeah. He didn't hesitate a second either.
Well, those politicians, you know, they don't want to be lost. They're at a loss for words, you know.
Where do you come up with this favorite fish? I mean, where does that come from?
I'll tell you where that came from. I was down in L.A. when I lived down in L.A., and I was hired to go cover some celebrity tennis tournament in Palm Springs, you know. So I was down there with this crew, and so finally Farrah Fawcett won the tournament, and the producer says, okay, go out and ask her, you know, how it feels to win, you know. And I'm like walking across the court, and I'm going, I can't ask a question as stupid as that. You know what I mean? I was rankled by that, you know, and I walked toward Farrah Fawcett. And I don't know where it came from, but it just popped out of my mouth. You know, I stuck the thing in front of her face, the mic. I said, Farrah Fawcett, what's your favorite fish? You know,
what'd she say?
I can't recall. I also, when they were having this whole Watergate hearing to impeach Nixon, and there was the big day where the Senate was going to decide, and all the newsmen were up there, and I happened to be in Washington doing something else. And this wasn't What's Your Favorite Fish. We were doing a promo for Sonny Bono. That was it. Same kind of idea, though. And this big deal senator came out, and everyone was waiting for him to speak, Frank Reynolds and these other people. And I got my mic in there ahead of everybody, and I said, you know, how do you feel about Sonny Bono? That was another one of those moments, you know, because we were doing some promo for ABC about Sonny Bono. But anyway, Frank Reynolds, I remember, was really bugged with me.
Well, Frank Reynolds, I remember, called Paul Krasner the most dangerous man in America at one point. And he was, you know, in the spirit of – Krasner would do those kinds of things like you and Coyle did, except they were – just one that comes quickly to mind. They hired a woman – this is kind of really irreverent in many ways, but they had her dress as a nun, and she got off a plane – and there were a bunch of people, this was at Kennedy Airport, watching this, and she came out and they started grabbing at her and, you know, I mean, hugging and, I mean, going into mad kind of passionate embraces. And, you know, that was the yuppie stuff back in the day. You actually worked in TV with Tennessee Ernie, didn't you?
Tennessee Ernie Ford. Boy, you've really done some research. Tennessee Ernie Ford, who a lot of people won't remember, his popular song was
16 Tons.
16 Tons, What Do You Get? He did a network television show from KGO here in San Francisco. Every day he lived down the peninsula, Tennessee, and he was in the peninsula, you know, near Bing Crosby.
It's funny when you become part of that nostalgia, you know, or Trivial Pursuit questions, right? Who was Mel Sharpe and Jim Coyle? Who were they? get those kind of, but you're still at it. I mean, you're still doing stuff in the commercial world, right?
Yeah. But anyway, Tennessee Ernie Ford was doing this show, and he brought a bus up from Hollywood to videotape us on the street. I mean, it wasn't like a little camera because they didn't have small cameras. And then they parked this huge bus. It was like, you know, one of these tour buses, and it had cameras and equipment inside. And so we did our first, video piece with Ernie Ford. I'm sorry, I digressed here.
No, that's all right. I brought up Tennessee Ernie, and, you know, we're coming up on a break, and I want to let people know that they're actually hearing the Big Money Jazz Band playing here. St. James Infirmary as we go out. And I also want to invite you who are listening, a lot of memories here with Mel Sharpe, and maybe you have some opportunity to talk to one of the real San Francisco originals. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us in conversation. That number is available to you, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org.
See my baby there. That's what I did. Guess where she was? Yes, she was stretched out on a long white table. Wow, she was sweet and bare. Let her go, God bless her. Wherever she may.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Before Borat and The Daily Show, there was Coyle and Sharp, the 1960s San Francisco radio comedy team. Mel Sharp and Jim Coyle helped pave the way for today's prankster comedians with their absurdist man on the street interviews. And we're talking with Mel Sharp about put-ons in his long career in the Bay Area, which includes not only broadcasting, but his Dixieland band, Big Money and Jazz. This is part of our first-person series on the leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area unique. And he is continuing to play Saturday afternoons at the Savoy Tivoli in San Francisco's North Beach. And there's an opportunity for you actually to speak to Mel Sharpe, either about memories or any questions you might have. Feel free to join us. We'd like to hear from you. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also join the conversation by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or our Facebook page, or email us forum@kqed.org. Just talking a little bit about that fish episode at the Democratic National Convention. What listeners didn't hear was somebody actually talking about lobster and you correcting them and saying lobster is a crustacean.
Yeah, right. So it was always a good moment when somebody would say lobster and I would.
Yeah. You'd be educational.
Yeah, right. Lobster is not a fish. It's a crustacean. Hey, Michael, I just want to mention one thing. You played that little musical thing there. I want to mention the guys in the band, not all personally, because there's so many different people playing the band. I've been really lucky to play with so many. There was San Francisco is filled with these great musicians, and no traditional jazz is whole history here that goes back to the Barbary Coast and Paul Whiteman. And but anyway, we have a great collection of musicians, and I am lucky to play with these people. And I'm, you know, to lead a Dixieland band, you don't have to know the keys, just the phone numbers, and that's
about
all I know.
You want to hear the power of radio?
Yeah.
One of them called in. First caller. Jim, you're on.
Mal, hey, this is Jim. I heard at 3:30 this morning you're going to be on forum, and I was overjoyed that Michael was going to recognize you, and you much well-deserved at that. And just want to say hi, and likewise say thank you for all the work that I've gotten through you over the past 20 years. I mean, I must have made at least 300,000.
This is Jim Gammon, one of our great trumpet players and an amazing human being. And it's been great sitting next to you, Jim.
How long have you two been playing together?
How long, Jim?
It's hard to know because we just sort of, when you network, I think we started sitting in. You came and sat in when I was playing with Oxtot's band, Dick Oxtot at the Point. And then all of a sudden, you hired me to be play on a gig or two, and then it just sort of went from there. And I'm one of your stable of of trumpet players.
Anybody that'll work for $50 can be in the band.
That's right.
But Jim has bought a house in Martinez this year with the money he made
on the basis of those $50 gigs. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. You know the old definition of the jazz musician: the guy who has a $5,000 horn, and he picks up his horn and he gets into his $1,000 car. And he drives 100 miles for a $50 gig.
That's us.
You know, you brought up an important subject. I'd like to hear what both of you have to say about it. I used to have Grover Sales on, and he was, I'm sure both of you remember him.
I do.
But he would get almost apoplectic about the meager earnings of jazz musicians compared to, say, rock and roll musicians who he felt were far inferior to jazz musicians. And this bothered him no end. You guys bothered by that?
Well, I won't go into the inferior or whatever nature of the music, but there's something going around on the internet. You know, somebody wants to hire a band, and the leader says, "Okay, that'll be $800 for a 4-piece band or something like that." And when the person's totally incensed, and then the musician says, "Well, how much would you pay for a plumber to come out on a Saturday night, to fix your toilet?" You know, and you figure all the practice time that goes into maintaining your talent on an instrument and so forth, and then people quibble over how much you might want to pay for some gigs. Or
Jim, I'm not going to pay you more money. $50 is it.
Oh,
I remember years ago.
You're the money.
I'm the leader. The band leader. But I remember years ago when we were playing at North Beach, not Jim, but another band at a place called Tipsy's on Broadway. Richard Hadlock, who's on the air on KCSM, our great jazz station. I have to mention that, by the way, where I was for 20 years. But I remember Richard Hadlock, we were playing in the Tipsies and, thing. And he said, "I'm not going to work for $7 a night anymore. I want $9. And I had to go into the owner, Pee Wee Ferrara, this little, kind of George Raft bartender owner guy. And I asked for $2 more for Hadlock. And Pee Wee waved his hand in the air. He says, "What are you talking about, Mal? I got breakage." And he pointed at his glasses. And then he pointed up at the ceiling. "I got lights. I got breakage." So that was the end of Richard Hadlock's raise. So we worked for $7 at Tipsy's.
Jim, good to hear from you. Keep playing.
Michael, I always enjoy your show. I never called in before, and it took Mal to make me do it, but terrific show. Thank you so much.
Glad to have you aboard, and thank you for the call again. Let me go to another caller here. That's Mike. Mike, you're on.
Hi. Mal, Mike Lipskin, just thanks for everything that you've done. It's been great knowing you for all this time and playing in your band once in a while. There was one.
Not enough, though, right, Mike?
Well, of course. That's why I'm standing on the street right now, waiting for you to interview me. Anyway, how did you come up with the? Do you remember the coming up with that skit, which I think is so surreal and beautiful, about telling somebody you'd monitor their parking meter? You and Jim would watch their parking meter while they went into a building. You remember that one?
I think so. I think that's the one where we tell him we'll watch the meter, and I think we want money from him now to stand out there or something. I don't remember the whole thing vividly.
Well, some guy thought that you were being he wasn't taking it. First he said yes, and then he realized that this must be absolutely surreal. And he started asking you why you wanted a certain amount of money, I think $1 or $5, to watch his parking meter. Anyway, that was one I remember in particular.
People come up to me all the time with these things, like you interviewed me about, you know, something like that, you know, and I sometimes I remember the things vividly, you know,
you
in black and
me
white.
About going to jail for income tax fraud. No, that's not true. Just a little joke there.
Mike Lipskin is a great stride pianist. He's been this is the guy who's on the air now. He's been at Davey Symphony Hall with the Stride Summit. His wife's a wonderful singer, and you were present at that wonderful photograph, Great Day at Harlem, weren't you, Mike?
Exactly, and I was interviewed by Michael Krasny several years ago about that photo, which was great, and we're doing San Francisco Jazz Stride Summit with Dick Hyman in August. Anyway, no plugs on that. It's just
you just got a good plug in, Mike,
thanks for
coming back to Forum here as a caller. You know, some of these bits, they're just so off the wall, I guess. A woman being told she could play a violin on the back of a drug coyote. At a flea market, giving people the opportunity to buy a vegetable in a sock. I mean, they are surreal. That's the only word to describe them.
Oh, I love that. We went out to the Marin Farmer's Market. The flea market.
Yeah.
I don't know how we got this idea. I just like the term vegetable in a sock. And we got all these vegetables, you know, like sweet potatoes, and we put them in socks. And we had, you know, artichokes in a different sock. And we had this stand out there. And we got more of a crowd like than the guy with the wristwatches. He was really bugged with us, you know, because we were these people. And you could only buy a vegetable in a sock the sock had to be your foot size, you know, so you're like, oh, you're size 11, you get the zucchini in the sock.
One of the funniest bits of yours that and it was visual, so I'm going to have to set it up that way, was a bit you did where, you know, you used to go to the, almost every corner in downtown San Francisco would have a place where you could buy the San Francisco Chronicle. You put a quarter in and you get the Chronicle. I need to mention that it was a Chronicle because it was often described as a fish wrapper paper. It's something about you guys with fish, you and Coyle.
I don't know.
You put this big fish in there, and the look on people's faces was just so – it was right out of Can and Camera. They put their quarter in, they'd open up, and there'd be this big, huge fish in there.
And they would scream. Some people were screaming. Some people shut the door in the news rack and then opened it up slowly again to make sure they were really seeing, you know, this huge fish. We got the biggest fish we could find.
There's a kind of boyish quality to all this, isn't there? I mean,
immaturity? Are you getting at that?
No, I didn't use
that
word.
There's a juvenile, I have to say, Coyle and I, there's a juvenile aspect to this. You know, when you're young, I'll tell you what's kind of behind it all. You know, you want to have one up on grown-ups, you know? You want to, you know, pull the wool over people's eyes because you want to feel superior. And Coyle was a big reader of Nietzsche and Schopenhauer, and he had this whole, you know, thing about, you know, kind of dominating people in some strange way with his words.
We're going to go to more of your calls in a moment. I want to go to some emails. Brenda in Oakland says, I used to wait and wait to hear Mal Sharpe's Man on the Street when I was growing up in San Francisco. He is without doubt the original from which all others have derived. Think Betty White's program. Thanks, Mal. Thanks, Michael Krasny, for bringing Mal to me once more. Glad to do that. And Patrice and Charlie in Fairfax say, hi, Mal. We'd like to know what you think of Sacha Baron Cohen's Ali G.
You know, is that Charlie? I love Borat, and I loved Ali G, and I always had the feeling he could have heard some Coyle and Sharp. There's one scene in there where he goes to eat at some wealthy people's homes, and he starts screwing with the food. I would, this is immodest of me, I guess, but, you know, I would love to have Borat play me in something. I mean, I can relate to him. I think he's got that sick sense of humor. I like seeing that. I'm not envious or jealous or anything when people
The Ali G stuff and Borat stuff was very funny.
Yeah, he's brilliant. That's a great, great film.
Well, not all of your interview subjects were as cooperative as some that we heard before the break. Here's another prank. Let's hear it.
Hey, excuse me. Sorry to disturb you. Do you drive this beer truck here during the day?
What do you mean here?
I mean, you drive the beer truck around the city during the day.
Yeah.
Well, I have a bet with this gentleman that I can withstand physical pain, and I would be willing to give you part of the bet. What I have said to him is that a heavy vehicle, a large vehicle, could run over my foot or my hand, and that I will not wince, and I will not show any pain whatsoever. All you have to do is back up this big beer truck.
What, you think I'm nuts?
Why not?
You think I'm stupid? I'll lose my job.
Why would you lose a job? We just do it here very quietly on a back street. You'd run over his foot. And...
not me.
Why? What is negative about it?
Negative is that, who are you guys?
We're just two guys who have a bet and...
two guys that liable to sue my company, too.
No suing at all.
Count me out.
Would you lower the beer barrel on my hand?
Not me. Talk to somebody else, please. Don't bother me.
You could settle a bet. We'd split with you. It's a $200
bet.
What?
We'd split.
I'm no pigeon.
I'll tell you what. Forget we ever mentioned the bet to you. You come out and get in the truck. He'll just put his foot under the wheel. You don't know he's there. You run over his foot.
No. We'll give you $50.
Don't bug me, Mac. Don't give me a nickel.
Even before you started, you just
complied.
I don't
want to even hear anymore.
Oh, you'll do it for nothing.
I'll do it for nothing. I won't even do nothing.
Haven't you ever wanted to run over somebody's foot?
I think you're both nuts.
In what sense?
Why don't you go grab one of those buses or a streetcar? They pay off good.
Putting a man through a kind of moral catechism there, I mean, in terms of making a decision.
You know, San Francisco, down in the Embarcadero, where all the Embarcadero Center buildings are now. But before that, it was the produce district. Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course. In fact, who's the produce guy? He just died. Joe Carcione.
Just passed away. So we would love to go down into this warehouse district and bug these truck drivers. I mean, Coyle and I, we would have a hidden tape recorder and just look for these guys because they were tough. We loved to get them yelling at us. Like, this guy was the typical guy we love to come across, a guy that's like going to yell and think about it. And
well, you have your fans, many of them, but there were also people who were critical. I think we may have one of those on the line here.
Uh-oh.
Sarah, hi. Sarah, are you with us?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yes, I am critical. I have always felt that the type of shtick that Mal Sharpe does is a very unfair sort of thing. That is, he gets people, let's assume that they are honest and naive, and he plays a trick on them. He's in on the joke. They're not in on the joke, and they often come out. I mean, I really appreciated that last bit where the guy said no and no and no again. But most people are willing to go along with what they think is an honest request, and he just makes fun of them. It's a form of bullying. I never liked him in the 60s, and I still don't like him.
Always appreciate candor, Mel.
Well, that's okay. You know, I've got to say, there is an aspect of what you're talking about that's true. And it always did make me a little uncomfortable. Cole was into it a little bit more than me. He lived to put people on. And
we're supposed to believe that?
What's that? He lived to put people on, you know. And I kind of got into this because I knew how to turn a tape recorder on and off, and I love the imagination of it. I love the imagination and the surrealism and the stories, and I love kind of meeting the people.
This is a time of absurdist humor, too, with the theater of the absurd and all that kind of stuff.
But we did get criticism on that level, and frankly, I can understand it, and there was an element of it. You know, when these sequences were over, we never really tried to get anybody seriously mad at us. And we, when the sequences were over, we always had to tell them it was a joke. We had to get a release from them. And I'd say 99% of the time, they kind of suddenly, because they'd been through this improvisational trip on the street, that they didn't mind it. And every once in a while, there was somebody that was bugged with us or a thing. But, I can understand what the woman was saying. There were lots of people.
I thought maybe you were coarse and vulgar and all that.
Well, I am coarse and vulgar. I'm not that coarse and vulgar, but I took a course in vulgarity. No, I can understand that point of view.
You know? There's a setup that you and Coyle do with a few other people, because I was struck by what the caller just said about you being in on the joke but the person not being in on the joke.
Yeah.
Where you do, and we actually used to do this as kids, you set it up to tell a joke. I think the joke is about a priest, a minister, and a rabbi, but the joke makes no sense. And then everybody starts laughing except the one person who hasn't been told.
Right.
And it is kind of embarrassing for that person, but it also shows that people are often kind of sheep in terms of following the herd. I mean,
yeah,
it's an important lesson.
That was a television bit. We had this man that we stopped on the street, and to his left he didn't know it was my wife, Sandra, and to his right was another friend of ours. So he's standing with three people, and I tell this joke that has a meaningless punchline, and Sandra and my friend, they both start laughing, and the guy in the middle is totally bewildered about, you know, what this joke is all about. But I don't know. That wasn't that
hardly
cool.
Invidious. Lisa joins us next. Lisa, you're on.
Yeah. Hey, Mal. It's Elisa. How are you?
Elisa Clancy,
morning
cup of jazz.
No, wait a minute. Did Mel line all you people up to call?
No, he didn't.
Hector you to call here?
I didn't call anybody and say I was going
to
be on the show.
What I wanted to say, Michael, is that he has this real shy spot, too, that you haven't touched on. Mal performed my wedding 15 years ago last week, and I think he got, you know, I got him a license over there in Alameda County, and he showed up, and I think, Mal, you were nervous when you realized that it was a real deal. It wasn't a shtick. It was a...
Well, here's the thing. This is what you're leaving out. This is Elisa Clancy from A Morning Cup of Jazz on KCSM. She was marrying Clint Baker.
I was his first producer down here.
When you asked me to do this, I said, I can't just go out and marry you in a normal way. And I said, why don't I do it as a rabbi? Neither of you is Jewish, and I'll get a tallis and a yarmulke, and I'll perform the ceremony as a rabbi. So I thought that was going to be interesting and funny, and they were having it up at the Brazil Room. But, you know, so I got the tallis and the whole thing, and the night before the thing, I thought, you know, this is crazy. There's going to be relatives from out of town. They're not going to think this is funny. You know, this is really stupid. I'm going to go out and stand in front of like 100 people, you know.
And then he gave us a test.
I had some tests, but, you know, and I went in and I pleaded with her to-be husband's father. I said, please, let me get out of this. Let me just marry them without the yarmulke and the rabbi shtick. He said, no. He said, it'll be funny. And so I did it. But thanks for bringing that up, Elisa.
So does that make that marriage legal? Were you?
Yeah. No, I got
it. You invested to perform marriage?
Yeah, you go down and get a license. You know, there was a legal aspect to it.
I just want to make sure that you were still legal, Elisa.
Are you legally married, Elisa?
As far as I know, Mal. As far as I know.
Good of you to call, Elisa. Thank you for the call. Pat wants to know about Mal's movie, The Old Spaghetti Factory.
Oh, yeah, we did a my wife and I bought this mural in a junk store. It was a big mural painted in the Spaghetti Factory back in 1959 or so, and it had about 40 people in it. What was her question again?
Wants to know about the movie?
Yeah. So we did this. We bought this mural, and Enrico's just would put it up in their cafe there, it was in there.
Well, Mel, I think we have somebody on the line who may also add to this. is this Mark who actually owned Enrico's?
Mal, I just wanted to let you know that how much we love having you play down there every Friday night for 10 years, and I have such vivid memories of you're discovering that huge mural at the inside of the Spaghetti Factory.
You helped him put it up, Mark?
Yeah, I came over to Mal's house in Berkeley where he had it, and we loaded it in a car, and one of us had to hang out one side of the car to hold it in going across the Bay Bridge. Finally got it over to Enrico's and put it up. And it was there for years behind the band where they played. Then Mal put together a huge party in honor of the mural, and all the people who were in San Francisco who were in that mural, who were all people who hung out at the Spaghetti Factory, came down, and we had a huge Sunday afternoon party, which was really extraordinary. And then Mal built a whole movie around mural, and it was just an extraordinary project, and it's been a privilege knowing Mal the entire 20 years.
What a speech. But you're still paying him $50 only, huh?
Well,
good night.
Yeah, first of all,
you're gonna pull that stuff about the like Pee Wee did about the.
I got breakage. Yeah. I got lights. Mark, thanks a lot. You know it was our best job. It was one of our best jobs because we had to wear neckties. You know, Turk Murphy said the band should always look better than the customers. So it was our last job where we actually wore neckties, Mark. And I still have a closet full of some excellent ties. I wanted to say, we filmed a lot of those people. We found a lot of people in the mural that had been painted 50 years before, and we filmed them. William Farley was one of the directors, my wife, Sandra, and I, and William Farley made that film. And it got on public television, and it sort of rejuvenated North Beach. It was a wonderful thing because a lot of these people were living in little rooms that had been flamenco dancers at the old Spaghetti Factory. And it kind of brought the community together. And the mural is at the Cafe Divine now, right off Washington Square. It's sitting up there. And we moved it there after Enrico's. And so people can go in and see it. And it's still rolling along.
Our guest still rolling along is the inimitable Mal Sharp. We'll get another caller on. Todd, that's you. Hi.
Hi. I've known Mel since Los Angeles. He got me into advertising. He was doing radio commercials down there. And so I used to use Mel to do voiceovers a lot. Hi, Mel.
Todd, it's you.
Yes, it's me.
How many more jobs have you had now? Todd had a great business card. It had every agency he'd ever been fired from. There were like, how many? With lines through it.
You know that line about, since you're talking about L.A., that line of Jackie Mason's about the guys who go up to you in Hollywood and give you a card, I'm a producer of this, I'm a producer. They produce cards is what they produce.
Correct. This one at the bottom said, advertising writer, very experienced. But one time we were in San Diego and we were doing a radio commercial with Mal's voiceover and carrying the tape recorder, and we went across to Tijuana, and he told one of those corner photographers with the zebra painted burrow guys, he said we had a dead friend in the trunk of the car, and we wanted one last photograph with him, and the three of us would sit on the little cart and have a photograph taken, and could we get a special deal because that guy wouldn't smile, our dead friend.
Guy was dead. Could we get a discount?
So we wanted a discount.
That was a great moment, Todd.
And the guy tried to get the police right away. It was terrific.
Todd, thank you for that. Let me just keep going back to memories and more memories. In fact, here's somebody who says, do you remember the human jukebox?
Yeah, sure. The guy that was down on Fisherman's Wharf, there was a guy down there, the human jukebox, sure. That was.
And was, Mike says, I'm a longtime fan, listener to the radio show. Hey, I'm a friend of Jim Gammon, living in L.A. in the 60s. I stood on the street so I could pick up KGO. I would listen to you guys during the Ira Blue Show. You are the best. Liz says, what a treat to hear you on forum. Can't get enough Mal Sharp. Always ready to hit the streets with you. Big, funny, and jazz, too. Roger from North Beach says, please thank Mel for years of making people happy with his music, jokes, heart, and mind. Does he have an opinion on the recent incident involving the pilots' names, which could be construed to be a symptom of the lack of journalism in for-profit media's race to be first? You're familiar with what we're talking about here with the Asian.
Yeah.
That was a prank. That was a punking thing, but it was also kind of awful and racist. And
yeah. And also, I thought, a lot of these stations now have, maybe KQED does too, but instead of having like trained people that are going to vet something like that, they'll have interns maybe, and that slipped by the intern, got a little too far. It was unfortunate that nobody saw that, and it's unfortunate.
They called and got an intern. That was the problem. The intern told verified them.
What's that?
The intern they spoke with.
Oh, that's
who
right.
Was supposed to be the authority or the source of the authority.
So they should pay people for these jobs, and then they wouldn't get this sloppy journalism.
Mary says a broad question. Beyond the naivete, how has the city changed over the years, in your opinion?
Well, a lot of it is the same, and that's what I love about San Francisco. I mean, North Beach, a lot of the neighborhoods, you know, really is very similar to me, you know, when I first came here in 1959. A lot of the city has changed. It's harder for me as a man on the street now to stand in downtown San Francisco because everybody's on their lunch hour. They're coming down the street and talking on cell phones. It's hard to get someone to stop when you're a man on the street. And hardly people, a lot of people don't even have lunch hours anymore, thanks to their bosses.
A lot of people know you, too. I mean, you're recognizable not only as a face, but even more as a voice. And somebody wants to know, Roger asks, how do you keep a straight face in some of these bits?
Well, when you have a chance to make money, you keep a straight face. I mean, you're desperate, you know, to get some good sequence. You don't laugh.
Oh, listen to this. A listener says, just a minor accuracy note, 16 tons, should it ever arise, there is some controversy, actually written by and much earlier first recorded by George Davis, often attributed to Merle Travis, as many websites do, or Tennessee Ernie Ford, which your guest just did. They both sing it, made it a big hit, of course, but Davis claimed they modified a few chords, but the original hit was his. Well, you never know when you open something up like that.
The geeks are out there.
They're out
the
there.
Geeks,
the experts.
The
Let's call them the experts.
The geeks are out there, yeah.
Terry says, yeah, when San Francisco was fun, I don't think it was only because we were young. Mel Sharpe and Borat, great match. So there's some casting to be done there.
There you go.
Well, I want to serve as your PR agent here a little bit because Mel Sharpe is going to have some appearances and I think listeners would like to know. Big Money and Jazz performs every Saturday again from 3 to 6 at the Savoy Tivoli in North Beach here in San Francisco on August 21st. They'll be at the Bateau Ivra, in Berkeley with Irish singer Melanie O'Reilly. August 22nd, they'll be at Armando's in Martinez. And on September 25th, Mel Sharpe will be moderating an event called Behind the Plank, a bartender's tour in North Beach with bartenders from Vesuvius, Pier 23, Enrico's, and Original Joe, sponsored by Telegraph Hill Dwellers Association. So good to have you with us, Mel. Thank you.
You did a great job, Michael. I like to watch other interviewers, you know, and you just can get people going. It's a talent.
I also like the shyness I see in you that they listen to.
I am shy. That's the truth.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.